Hey there, it's Eric. In this episode, we're doing a super deep dive on the awesome book, The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. I'm combining four parts into one super long episode, so we will see you on the other side of this quick break.
Welcome to The Plain Wealth, a show about wealth, health, and happiness. Join Eric Cooper and guests as they discuss what they are working on, working out, and what they are working for. All opinions expressed by Eric and guests are solely their own opinion and do not reflect the opinion of ELC advisors. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of ELC advisors may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
This podcast is brought to you in part by ELC advisors. ELC advisors is an efficient low-cost wealth management firm that brings Wall Street experience to Main Street at a fair price. Our fees are less than half of the national average. Experience well-priced advice today. ELCAdvisors.com.
My name is Eric. You have found yourself the Plain Wealth. Today, we're going to do a little book review, summary, I suppose, of The Psychology of Money. Go out and pick it up. Millions of copies sold. It's a great book. So we're going to dig in. Basically, I wish I had written this book. I'm not nearly the writer that Morgan Housel is, and I would never claim to be, but he does such a great job of encapsulating so many of the thoughts that a lot of us have around money that we don't really know we're having. I think Ramit Sethi gets into these. Ramit calls them money scripts. So we all have a little different terminology around, but Morgan, I think, does a really nice job of kind of digging in the psychology of money and what the problems are. All right, so let's jump into it. I just have a little outline here. Let's see how we're doing this. Okay, there I am, and there's Psychology of Money. All right, Psychology of Money is about the strange ways people think about wealth and happiness. Yep, no brainer. Psychology of Money. No one's crazy. Everyone looks at money through the lens of their past experience. So, I think this is very important. So, people may have an abundance mindset or a scarcity mindset. I will tell you this, even though I've had a good career and should theoretically be becoming a life from an abundance mindset, something in my DNA is still programmed where I have a scarcity mindset. So that's, you know, Ramit will talk about money scripts. This was baked into me. Money doesn't grow on trees. This is the thing that people say and think about. It's like, actually, there's a lot of money out in the world if you can be clever and think about ways to go get it. Money is fairly abundant if you're willing to learn about it, chase opportunity, move for opportunity, and understand markets. And I know this sounds almost a little charlatan-like, where, all you have to do is manifest it. I hate that. Stop. We're not talking about that. But you do need to realize your internal money script to say, you know, look, money is not evil. It's not awful. But it can be scarring, and we can be coming from a place of emotional trauma. Let's go back to my little outline here. Okay, I'm going to read this to you. Let's see. You can read what it's like to lose everything during the Great Recession, but you'll never bear the emotional scars. What does that mean? Until you live through it, you don't know how you're going to respond. So, furthermore, it's important to remember that until you live through the financial crisis or its consequences, you don't understand the way people behave the way they do. Okay. So I think that's important to dig into a little bit. Everyone thinks, so I frame this, my day job is an investment manager dealing with clients, and I frame every conversation like this, and people go, Eric, you're being a little bit ridiculous. I'm going to be fine. That's not how I will act in a time of crisis. But I frame every conversation in the context of how will you feel if your equities, your stock positions, are cut in half? If they're cut by 50%, what are you going to do? Are you going to hold on? Are you actually going to take some cash that you have on the sideline or in bonds and invest more into equities? Truth is, most people don't. The reason I have a job is more to be a psychologist or a money coach, if you will, because I'm facile with the markets, I understand how these things happen, how they recover. But really understanding your psychology around money and what are you going to do when there is a time of crisis. And if you came from a wealthy background, a wealthy family, you may think, yeah, no big deal. I saw my parents ride markets up and down over decades and it was no big deal. We never sold. If you come from maybe a little more of a humble background and have potentially a scarcity mindset, you might get nervous. You might be inclined to sell. Or if you just had a big win and you don't want to lose that money, now you're not willing to ride out the turbulence. So then that comes back to a conversation of asset allocation. We can dig more into all this later. All right, let's hit the next topic in this chapter. Luck and risk. Nothing is as good or as bad as it seems. So Bill Gates, richest man in the world, says every outcome in life is guided by forces other than individual effort. Bill Gates went to a high school that had one of the only computers in the world. Was that just lucky? Was that because he's so smart? No, it was that he was a product of his circumstance, which is okay for him. In finance, similar things happen. You may have graduated at the peak of the financial crisis in 2008. You may have graduated at peak COVID, and it was tougher to interview and get jobs. So now you could be potentially years behind in career because you weren't in office. You didn't have a management exposure. That's just luck or bad luck. I personally graduated in a time where the dot-com bubble was imploding. We had 9/11. The towers just came down going into a job market. You may say that was bad luck, but there was kind of a reset when I was coming through the markets. I'd already experienced a lot of their turbulence or whatever when I was looking for employment in earnest. So was that lucky? Well, I got to build my career until the great financial crisis, and then I had stability. I understood what I was doing. I was already established a little bit, as opposed to graduating right into the great financial crisis. So I got a leg up, right? So you have to grant others grace. We just don't know where they're coming from or what they're doing. And we have to understand a lot of what we achieve in life is circumstance and luck and maybe not skill. And the similar thing goes to investing. Like, we think the greatest investors in the world are the most skilled. We don't know. A lot of them might just be lucky. Is that good or bad? We don't know. It's hard to measure. It's hard to gauge. We do know most investment managers, active investment managers, underperform the market, and the ones who outperform, there is very little persistence. But when they do, was that luck or is that skill? They were just right. We don't really know, but it's an important concept to understand what is luck versus skill versus where you are in life versus kind of granting others in the world some grace and having a little humility around what's going on in the world. Okay, let's get to the next big topic. Let's see. This is great. Never enough. So what does that mean? The goalposts keep moving. So Rajat Gupta, he was a partner at a consulting firm and then on the board of Goldman and then started trading on inside information. By all accounts, and this, I think I was at Goldman at this point when this happened. By all accounts, he had won in life. He won the game, yet there wasn't enough. Bernie Madoff had everything, power, freedom. You can't get to a point in life and then not have enough. There's no the big takeaway in the book is there's no need to risk what you have, and this is kind of a Buffett quote, and need for what you don't have and don't need. The hardest financial skill, it seems, is to stop the goalposts from moving. What's another way of saying all this? Never enough. It's greed. We're playing this game, and if we got lucky by, if you live in America, born in the U.S., in a prosperous economy, with lots of opportunity, with educational opportunities, you can learn online nowadays. Heck, there's remote work for a lot of really good jobs. But it seems there's never enough. you may have gotten in early at a tech company or a financial firm, and now the goalpost moving. I know this happened in my own life. If I went back 20 some odd years and I was a college kid, if you said, hey, you'll have $100,000 in your bank account, I would have been over the moon. If you told me that today, the most you'll ever have in your bank account is $100,000, I wouldn't feel good about it, because the goalposts move. There's never enough. As soon as you hit one financial milestone, the goalposts move. As soon as you hit one fitness milestone, the goalposts move. As soon as you get established, then you want a relationship. As soon as you have a relationship, then you want kids. Like, it just keeps moving. And the concept, back to the book, is people do really weird things, even when they have plenty, to try to advance their financial agenda. So don't do those people. Understand that when enough is enough. Jack Bogle, I think one of his last books, he's the founder of Vanguard, wrote a great book called Enough. You just need to understand when you can check out of the game or reprioritize. Like, once you have some financial security, lean into your hobbies, lean into your family, lean into your community. At some point, there is enough. Okay, next topic. Confounding compounding. This is great. The big idea. Our minds are not built to handle the reality that compounding leads to logic-defying results. I'm going to read this verbatim. My notes here. Warren Buffett's fortune isn't due to just being a good investor. Rather, it's due to being a good investor since he was a child. That might be a little extreme, but yes, he started getting into the stock market as a child. His father, I think he was a politician and also a broker, so he had early exposure to investing. As of this writing, says Morgan Housel, Warren Buffett's net worth is $84.5 billion. I think it's much higher today. But of that, $84.2 billion was accumulated after his 50th birthday. The counterintuitive nature of compounding leads to even the smartest of us to overlook its enormous power. I know that sounds ridiculous, too far-fetched, but if I can leave you with one thing for this video, is the power of compounding is enormous. If you can, the earlier you can start investing to start getting the annual returns, I don't know, you pick your number. Some people say the stock market returns 8% a year. The real math kind of shows closer to 11% a year, net of inflation. Okay, maybe it's back to that 7-8 number. I don't know, but the compounding matters. So learn about the rule of 72. So the rule of 72 is just a quick rule of thumb to help you learn how quickly money doubles. So if you can get a 7% return, you divide 72 by 7, your money should double in 10.2 years is the rough math. Rule of 72, if you're getting a 10% return, 72 divided by 10, your money will double in 7 years. Okay, what does that mean? Well, that means you're keeping ahead of inflation and doubling your money every 7 to 10 years. If you can do that for decades, you are going to be so far ahead of the game, it's almost inconceivable. At some point, you can build your wealth to where you can live off just the wealth, if you are saving a large percentage of your income and your salary, because your money can double. And I'm talking about, yeah, if you just started saving at 65, it's a tougher game for you. It really is. And there's no sugarcoating that. But if you're watching this video and you're 18, if you're 15, and you have 50 years to compound your money, or 40 years to compound your money, so every 10 years you can double as much as you're saving, I mean, that is astronomical. Let's go back to these numbers. We think of Warren Buffett as the richest man in the world. $84.2 billion of his $84.5 as of this writing came after his 50th birthday. I know, it's very strange. Okay, I'm going to leave this lesson here. Pick this book up. This was just 1 through 4 chapters. The next video will pick up chapter 5. We'll see you next time. Thanks for watching. Ooh, thanks for coming back. I'm Eric. This is The Plain Wealth. This is part two of the book review of The Psychology of Money, or I don't know if it's a review. We're digging in. I know that last time that light was a little weird. You know, just mess around with the camera work here. I'm a rookie to all this. All right, we're going to jump back into the book, Psychology of Money. All right, go back and watch part one if you have not done it. Morgan Housel, amazing book. Wish I'd written it. We are on to chapter five. All right, let's take a look. Getting wealthy versus staying wealthy. The big idea. Good investing is not about making good decisions. It's about consistently not screwing up. Let me say this differently. You only have to get rich once. One time, you have to get rich. Then you have to stay rich. Okay? You only have to get rich one time, then you have to stay rich. Munger has a great quote. He's like, basically, Charlie Munger, if you don't know who that is Warren Buffett's kind of right-hand man. He's worth a couple $1 billion, famed investor, Berkshire Hathaway, was an attorney, and then he joined Warren at some point 50 years ago, I don't know. But he basically says you got to fight like hell to get that first $100,000. Then you have some optionality. That first $100,000 give you some breathing room. Then you can start working on things. But don't mess that first $100,000 up, because if you're always coming behind the eight ball, if you don't have enough money for an emergency, if you're paying 20% on a credit card and not earning, you know, 10% a year in the market, life's going to be a struggle. You got to get that first $100,000, then you have a little bit of optionality. But more importantly, once you actually get rich, beyond $100,000, not $200,000, $300,000 plus $1 million, now you just have to stay rich. Don't screw it up. All right, let's dig in a little more here. What does Morgan have to say? Housel writes that if he had to summarize money success in a single word, it would be survival. Survival, not growth. Survival. It would be survival, not growth or brains or insight, but survival. The ability to stick around for a long time without wiping out or being forced to give up makes the big difference, the biggest difference when it comes to making money. Compounding only works when you give your money years to grow. And it's not 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. It's 10, 15, 20, 30 years you need. You don't need, but you want compounding to grow your wealth. Don't act against your own best interests. I saw recently this week. So Beyonce, love her music. I like her husband's music better. But she announced a new world tour. Maybe it's a national tour. I don't know. I'm guessing it's a world tour. Several headlines came out that said people were taking money out of their 401k in order to buy Beyonce tickets. Please don't do that. For the love of God, don't do that. Let your money work and compound. Walk some dogs or babysit or flip pizzas for a few weeks if you need Beyonce tickets. But don't touch your 401k. You have to let the money compound to buy yourself a future of security. I know you're going to have the stories like, oh, but we got to see Beyonce. Yeah, but at what cost? Again, this is not talking poorly about Beyonce. This is talking poorly about people who are tapping their 401k in order to buy concert tickets. Please don't do that. Okay, moving on. Number six chapter in the book, Tails You Win. The big idea, you can be wrong half the time and still make a fortune. I think it's closer. You can be wrong like 49% of the time. You kind of want to win slightly more than you lose, but that's okay. Let's dig in. Anything that is huge, profitable, famous, or influential is the result of a tail event, an outlying 1 in 1,000 or millions event. And most of our attention goes to the things that are huge, profitable, famous, or influential. When most of what we pay attention to is a result of a tail, it is easy to underestimate how rare and powerful they are. Okay. We look at folks who kill it in life. Let me find this chapter. His subheading here: you can be wrong half the time and still make a fortune. There are tail events. You might pick the one great company to work for. You want to get on the rocket ship that is going to explode. You want to work at Facebook earlier. You actually, I used to work at Goldman Sachs. I know people who were pre-IPO partners at Goldman Sachs who made vast fortunes. Was it because they were great? No. It was timing. It was luck. It was a tail event to be a partner at Goldman Sachs before they went public. Let's see. I'm going to read this to you. I've been banging away at this thing for 30 years. I think the simple math is some projects work and some don't. There's no reason to belabor either one. Just get on to the next. That's from Brad Pitt accepting the Screen Actors Guild Award. So I think kind of the takeaway is we just don't know, but you have to increase the surface area of the risk you're taking, of the connections that you're forming, of the career that you have. You need to get out in the world and create your art. You need to make your mark with whatever it is your pursuit is, if it's music, if it's finance, you're an accountant, whatever, but you have to increase the surface area of product that you're putting in the world, because we just don't know. And something will hit over time. You don't have to be right all the time. You are going to have the ability to create impact in the world, to create wealth for yourself by increasing your number of at-bats. You will find the 1,000 true fans that, is it Mark Kelly? What's his name? I'll find his name. That's the senator. Find your 1,000 true fans. That can create you fabulous wealth. That can do great things for you. But you have to keep going. You can't just be a hermit and never take any risks. Okay, I'm not going to belabor that one anymore. Let's look at the next one. Freedom. The big idea: controlling your time is the highest dividend money pays. Let's read a little more. The highest form of wealth is the ability to wake up every morning and say, I can do whatever I want, when I want, with who I want, for as long as I want. This is more than your salary, more than the size of your hours, more than the prestige of your job, more than anything is the highest dividend money pays. I think this is a great point. So what's the point of actually trying to build wealth, trying to build a reserve is, and on Wall Street, they call it FU money. I think you know what FU means. You need to have optionality. You need to build up enough of a nest egg. Back to that Munger first $100,000. You need to get to a place that you feel comfortable to walk away. If you have a boss who's unethical, if you want to pursue a passion that you think has real legs, if you want to focus on your health, if you want to focus on your family, if you want to have 4 kids and stay at home with them, it requires wealth. It requires a steady income. It requires good planning. But time is the highest thing. Let's go back. I want to read it again. Controlling your time is the highest dividend money pays. Time is what's important. So all other resources are completely renewable, except maybe oil that we're burning at too fast of a pace, but that is another topic. Time is the only non-renewable resource. We have, if we're lucky, I don't know what the statistics are, 80-something years for a woman, mid-70-something years for a man, or the averages maybe, then it's over. So time is the biggest resource, but we have a crazy invention, the biggest technological invention of all time. I know we don't think about it that way. Money is an invention. It's just a myth, a story, a tool that we all buy into. It's an invention. It allows us to transport through decades. If you have a bunch of wealth now, you can think about your future. You can think about next week without having to basically go pick berries and corn and bale hay like I did when I was growing up. it allows you to transport your time to basically another dimension, the future. So get as much money as you can to buy yourself freedom. And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to not get your Starbucks, although that's probably a good place to start. Drink instant coffee like I do. Instant coffee fans. Or do it, you know, at home pour over. Those are great too. But you have to get your freedom by having some financial security to buy back your time. Pretty simple concept. Okay, I'm going to leave that here for this round. And we will see you next time. Thanks for watching.
Hello, I am Eric. This is The Plain Wealth. And welcome back to part three of a review, a deep dive into The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. It's an incredible book. If you've not watched part one and two, dig in a little bit and my commentary around it, check them out. So we are now at chapter eight. This is the man in the car paradox. What is the man in the car paradox? The big idea in this chapter is no one is impressed with your possessions as much as you are. People tend to want wealth to signal to others that they want to be liked and admired. But in reality, those other people often bypass admiring you, not because they don't think wealth is admirable, but because they use your wealth as a benchmark for their own desire to be liked and admired. Point being, no one cares about your clothes, your watch, your cars, your house, to the extent you think they care. They care about it because they are imagining themselves having those things. But when you pull up to the valet in your Ferrari or whatever, no one's impressed. They don't look at you like, man, this guy made it and he deserves my respect and admiration. They think, I want that Ferrari and what would life be like with it? If you want respect and admiration, Morgan Housel has a good line here. If respect and admiration are your goal, be careful how you seek it. Humility, kindness, and empathy will bring you more respect than horsepower ever will. I like to work out. And the man in the car paradox has perfect parallels to the man with muscles paradox. Everyone in the gym, you know, some people start going to the gym for their own health and fitness, but sometimes it devolves into steroid abuse and gym culture that I think just gets overblown. And men and women think, oh, I want to get all these muscles and I want to be strong and shredded so I can attract a mate of my choosing. Well, generally, men in the gym get muscles thinking they want to attract women. They just attract other men. They got guys going, bro, how'd you get so big? I don't know why I think gym guys sound like Cali surfers, but I think you just have to be careful. What you think is going to bring you respect and admiration isn't necessarily what you think they are. It's being kind to others. It's treating others with grace. It's being generous. So yeah, you can have the car and the house. Will it garner you the admiration and respect from others that you think it will? Unlikely. So I think this is a good chapter. All right, so moving on. This is great. Chapter 9. Wealth is what you don't see. The big idea. Spending money to show people how much money you have is the fastest way to have less money. Spending money to show people how much you have is the fastest way to have less money. So you can flex. You can buy the car and the house, but now you have less money. If you buy the $1 million house, if you can get an 8% return on that $1 million that's invested, let's say, I don't know, these are nominal numbers, not net inflation. You can nitpick all you want, and maybe it's not 8% forever, but let's say you kept the $1 million invested, you got an 8% return. Someone do that math. We don't like to do public math, but 8% on $1 million is $80,000 a year. If you buy that $1 million house, you're foregoing the $80,000 of investment returns for that year. And yes, real estate can appreciate in value. This is a whole other conversation of renting versus buying, and isn't real estate consumption, isn't an investment. There, we have deep
rooted things about home ownership in this country that we can get into another topic. But let's go back. Wealth is what you don't see. I like this. We tend to judge wealth by what we see because that's the information we have in front of us. But the truth is that wealth is what you don't see. Rich is a current income. Nice cars purchased, diamonds bought, but wealth is hidden. Read that again. Rich is a current income. Nice cars purchased, diamonds bought, but wealth is hidden. Wealth is what you don't see. There's a great picture of Buffett and Gates. Think of them what you will, but some of the richest men in the world. And, you know, they're just kind of dressed like old guys. They said whatever it was at the time, $200 billion of net worth and not a Gucci belt in sight, just because they dress plainly. It's what you don't see, right? It's ownership in companies. It's ownership in farmland. It's ownership in real estate and stocks and bonds. It's not your Rolly. It's not your Escalade. Wealth is what you don't see. All right, let's go back. Let's finish reading this. It is an option not yet taken to buy something later. Not knowing the difference is a source of countless poor money decisions. So back to the car example, you can drive a $150,000 G-Wagon or Range Rover, or you can drive a $30,000 Corolla. The difference is actually wealth. One is consumption, and one is having a rainy day fund and investments that are going to grow for you in the future. I know that's the answer people don't like, because consumption's fun. Nice things are nice, and I completely understand it. But wealth is what you don't see. So don't buy things to impress others. Invest in your own future. All right, next topic, moving on. Save money. The only factor you can control generates one of the only things that matter: saving money. Building wealth has little to do with your income and investment returns and more to do with your savings rate. More importantly, the value of wealth is relative to what you need. A high savings rate means you can have lower expenses than you otherwise could, and having lower expenses means your savings go further than they would if you spend more. I mean, chalk this up into, yeah, I get it. I should save more, but you can make $100,000, but if you spend $101,000, you're poor. You can make $1 million. If you spend $1 million and $1, you're poor. You can make $50,000, but if you can save $20,000 of that, you're rich. You're doing better. You're advancing the ball. You're marching down the field towards victory if you can save. And not only save, this is a big takeaway. So saving is important. Investing is equally important. So yes, you want to have a rainy day fund 3 to 6 months. I know most of society, something 40 to 60% can't afford a $1,000 emergency. We need to work on that societally. We have too much consumption. I know credit card debt is approaching $1 trillion, near all-time highs. So we're hustling backwards in society where we're paying 20% APR on credit cards and we're not investing 10% to get 10% returns. So we're doing it backwards. But we need to save more and invest more. After you get your 3 to 6 months emergency fund and an online high yield savings account, you have to invest the difference and think about investing for decades. Okay, I'll beat that up. Reasonable is greater than rational. What does that mean? The big idea, Morgan says, aiming to be modestly reasonable works better than trying to be coldly rational. All right, so what does that mean? He says, do not aim to be coldly rational when making financial decisions. Aim to be pretty reasonable, get that out, is more realistic, and you have a better chance of sticking with it for the long run, which is what matters most when managing money. You're not a spreadsheet, you're a person. Okay, so we all hear the gurus preaching, drink your coffee at home. Hell, I think I said it in one of these videos. That's reasonable. the rational approach would always be drink coffee at home, to never go to Starbucks, to never splurge, to never have consumption. But that's the point of wealth, is to live an enjoyable life doing things where you find value. I think you should cut to the bone on things that don't matter to you. If you don't care about your work computer, just use something that's 5 years old. As long as if you're just sending emails and browsing the web, you don't need the most incredible computer. But you should spend where it makes sense for you, right? Let me look. So I think this is good. Let me read from here. Academic finance is devoted to finding the mathematically optimal investment strategies. My own theory is that in the real world, people do not want mathematically optimal strategy. They want the strategy that maximizes for how well they sleep at night. So I use that term all the time, sleep well at night money. The optimal investment strategy might be mostly equities. But if you can't stick to that investment strategy, you're not a spreadsheet. The market sells off, you may want to sell off. Most people, even though the market returns 8 to 10% a year, they get investor returns are closer to 2 or 3% returns. They are missing out on wide swaths of return. There's a big gap on what investors individually actually get versus what the market return year to year. Why? Because people tend to be irrational, not reasonable, not even rational, but irrational when markets sell off. They panic. So when you're building a portfolio, yes, the optimal portfolio might be very equity weighted, just a little bit of bonds to help you damper volatility. But if you can't sleep with that portfolio, you might need more, a little bit more cash, a little more bonds or fixed income in your portfolio. So make sure you're doing the reasonable thing over the coldly rational thing. That's something you can stick with for decades. All right, I'm going to leave this one here. We will pick this up in the next video. Pick up this book. Hello again. I am Eric. This is The Plain Wealth. Welcome back to part 4. Sorry about the audio on part 3. We got it resolved. New little mic here. We are reviewing part 4, The Psychology of Money, written by Morgan Housel, an excellent book that you should all pick up and read because Morgan needs more money after selling millions of copies. On a side note, I am very sore. I do not recommend getting old spending too much time in the gym. But here we are. Okay, so we're moving on to chapter 12. Surprise! What does this mean, surprise? Let me get this on screen here. All right, the big idea in this chapter is history is an unassailable guide to the future. A trap many investors fall into is what Housel calls historians as prophets fallacy, an over-reliance on past data as a signal to future conditions in a field where innovation and change are the lifeblood of progress. Past performance is not indicative of future results. All right, I mean, this is like so trite and almost commonplace, like past performance is not guarantee any future results, but we just don't know, right? We have to stay invested. Do we know which companies are going to outperform? No. I think this book, it digs into this a bit. It says, history can be misleading guide the economy and the stock market because it doesn't account for structural changes that are relevant to the world. Take this tidbit. The 401k is only 42 years old. It is the main investment vehicle that people because, as I mentioned in a previous video, the pension system was effectively dismantled because corporate America got their hands around it and said, no, 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 you employees take your own retirement. We're not going to be responsible for it. And then the government didn't want to backstop the pension plans. Obviously, they're still out there, but they're gone for the most part. The Roth IRA is younger. It was only created in the 90s. This is one of the greatest tools of all time for saving. You put in post-tax money, you can take it out without tax in the future to grow your wealth. Obviously, there's income limits and contribution limits, but this has only been formed in the 90s, so things change. But the book goes into, look, we don't know what's going to happen in the world.
Great Depression, World War II, the Manhattan Project, vaccines, antibiotics, ARPANET, September 11th, the fall of the Soviet Union. How do you invest around these world events? It's nearly impossible. Did the world know that of the billions of people who lived, we'd have Hitler, Stalin, Mao Zedong, Thomas Edison, Bill Gates, Martin Luther King? These are dramatic changes to society based on some individuals. How do you invest? You can't predict the future. You have to stay invested. You have to have broad market exposure to get invested in the right companies. Picking, you know, you could have said, hey, I want to invest in Enron because I live in Texas. By the way, I did. Enron imploded when I was graduating college. Everyone wanted to work at Enron, and all of a sudden it was not an entity anymore, right? No one could have predicted, well, some people did. There were people inside the firm who knew they were cooking the books, but to become the seventh largest company in America and then just implode overnight, like, history is confusing. I think this goes on to say, it proves my point that I was further say, don't buy individual securities because you can't predict history. Own the whole market. Own the companies that are going to do well. And maybe, you know, on the margins, you take 5-10% of your money. You can bet on some individual names if you want to trade around it. But you want to own the economy. You want to own all of history that's going to unfold. This lays it out. Very important. So Ben Graham, who wrote the Security Analysis in 1934, he was basically Warren Buffett's mentor. Just before he died, Graham was asked whether detailed analysis of individual stocks, a tactic he became famous for, remained the strategy he favored. He answered, in general, no. I am no longer an advocate of elaborate techniques of security analysis in order to find superior value opportunities. Wait, this is the guy who pioneered security analysis to find the stocks that are going to outperform. This was a rewarding activity, say 40 years ago, when our textbook was first published, but the situation has changed a great deal since then. Like, we still have tons of people trying to pick the stock, and I think that's good. I think price discovery is good. I think deep analysis of companies is good. I think people are on both sides of the debate of short sellers, if they're good or bad for the market, but rooting out fraud, I think, is good for the market over time. So anyway, the takeaway of this chapter, let me go back. History is an unassailable guide to the future, right? We don't know what's going to happen, what it has in store for us. And to that, I would say, own all of history, or said differently, own all the future. Own a low-cost index fund that gets you total market exposure to everything that's going to happen in the economy. And more than likely, you will probably be right as long as you stay the course. That may not have been Morgan's exact point, but that's my takeaway from this. All right, so we're going to move on to the next chapter. Chapter 13, Room for Error. Error. I got some New York. I got some Texas in me. It's all coming out. Okay, the big idea. The most important part of every plan is planning on your plan, not going according to plan. I know, that's nice and wordy. That's real clever. The most important part of every plan is planning on your plan, not going according to plan. It's clever. Let's see. Use room for error. Damn, I can't say that word. Use room for error when estimating your future returns. For his own investments, Housel assumes the future returns he'll earn in his lifetime will be a third lower than the historic average. This is probably good because most people, Morgan's saying he thinks it'll be a third lower than historic average. Let's call it somewhere between 9, 10, 11% over the last 40 years for the S&P 500. To be on the safe side, assume 6, 7, 8%. Furthermore, most people, even though historic average is, let's say, it's called 10, they only get 3 because they're trading against their best instincts, or using their best instincts, which is trading against their best interest because they're in the market, they're out of the market, they're trying to time. They buy high, they sell low instead of buying low and selling high, or just staying the course and letting their dividends compound and reinvesting those dividends for decades, which is the right answer. But let's go back. Leave room for error. So he saves more than he would if I assume the future will resemble the past. It's his margin of safety. All right. So margin of safety is just the biggest no-brainer, right? We don't know what's going to happen in the economy. We don't know what's going to happen in the market. Like we talked about this earlier, but in the previous video, but what is your sleep well at night money? What is your rainy day fund? You should have 3 to 6 months in a rainy day fund. You should have some percentage of your asset allocation in a sleep well at night fixed income or bond fund, right? Short term, maybe some intermediate bonds. Obviously, those did not perform well in this rising interest rate environment of late. But going forward, they will probably do fine. A 60-40 portfolio would do fine. Even though theoretically, if you're invested for decades, you should probably have something like a 90-10 or an 80-20 or 70-30. But if you want some conservatism, again, I said this before, you only have to get rich once. Then you have to stay rich. So allow for error in your calculations. Grant that the world, you may not know what's going to happen. So have some conservatism in your investment approach. Quit swinging for the fences and start hitting singles and doubles over time if once you've already accumulated enough assets. Okay, let's move on to the next chapter. You'll change. What does Morgan say? The big idea, long-term planning is harder than it seems because people's goals and desires change over time. They sure do. I think one of the bigger things that I've learned dealing with people and their wealth and managing money is the goalpost move. Like some people thought, oh, I'll be happy when, which is basically setting yourself up for failure. I'll be happy when I have $1 million is most people's like common retort. And then they get the $1 million and they go, oh, I don't really feel that. I don't feel much differently now. Well, you do. You just don't want to admit it. You now actually have some financial security, some financial peace of mind. You have some optionality, but they're not even granting themselves that pleasure because their goals and desires have changed. The goalposts have moved. They've done well in life. They feel good for a minute, and then the plans change. All right, let's go back. Furthermore, Morgan says, we're such poor forecasters of our future selves that there is a term for this phenomenon, the end of history illusion. We're aware of how much we've changed in the past, but we grossly underestimate how much our personalities, desires, and goals will change in the future. We are never fully formed human beings. Our desires change, our goals change. You might want to live in the woods in retirement, or you may want to live in the middle of a very urban environment. When you spent most of your life in the suburbs, you might want access to culture and to history. We just don't know what our future selves is going to desire, right? Maybe we're on the hedonic treadmill. We adapt to changes in environment and we want better things or nicer things. Or you might hit some life milestone and you decide to become a minimalist. And now you want to give your money away, right? We just don't know who we are. So allow yourself some grace and grant yourself optionality to change as you mature and as you age. You're a different person at 60 than you are at 40. By the way, in my mid-40s, I don't recommend hitting mid-40s, but I know I'm as healthy and young as I'll ever be. So I can't imagine how much my body's going to hurt at 60. I just came from work, in case you couldn't tell. All right. Furthermore, Housel writes, imagining a goal is easy and fun. Imagine a goal in the context of the realistic life stress that grow with the competitive pursuits is something entirely different. When you're making long-term decisions, then remember to avoid the extreme ends of financial planning and accept the reality of changing your mind. So we just don't know who we're going to be. What do you think you need 3 million to retire, 5 million? Some people, I like to read on the Fat Fire subreddit. People will have $15 million and they're like, I don't know if I can leave my job or if I should sell my company. For all intents and purposes, they won in life and they still feel beholden, like they need more. Then you read Lean Fire, which is some people, you get $500,000 and they try to retire at 30 with $500,000, which I wouldn't recommend. I don't think that's necessarily enough money to retire, but maybe I'm wrong, to live off the rest, just off dividends and interest for the rest of your life. Like maybe your wealth grows, but again, I would go back to Morgan's previous rule is just be a little more conservative in your approach. And again, it's finding what that balance is. If you read Bill Perkins' book, I know I'm mixing my books, but Die with Zero, he said, look, we all think we need way more than we need. And this probably goes back to Tim Ferriss's 4-hour work week. Like, we need less. You need a monthly deal, and you can live like a king with maybe less than you think, right? Okay, so I know I'm all over naming different books, but you'll change. So allow yourself optionality and a financial plan that can change with your goals and desires moving forward, right? We don't know who we're going to be. We think we're locked in time. We're going to be very different people in 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years. So, and allow that that's okay, and build yourself a financial plan that will accommodate that. All right, let's not belabor that anymore. Chapter 15, nothing's free. The big idea, everything has a price, but not all prices appear on labels. So this book, this chapter kind of goes into volatility in markets. I want to see if I can find something. All right, so that's what markets look like. They just go up. Man, they go up. But there is a lot of, there are a lot of big dips in between, right? Let's see. Highlight this. The price of investing success is not immediately obvious. It's not a price tag you see, so when the bill comes due, it doesn't feel like a fee or getting something good. It feels like a fee for doing something wrong. Hauser writes, thinking of market volatility as a fee rather than a fine is important, and developing the kind of mindset that lets you stick around for long enough for investment gains to work in your favor. So this is what happens. A volatile market comes, and we lose our minds. We can't get out of our own ways because we feel like we're being punished for doing the right things, right? Volatility is the price we pay for returns. So I like this down here. Few investors have the disposition to say, I'm actually fine if I lose 20% of my money. This is doubly true for new investors who have never experienced a 20% decline. I think we saw a lot of this in this recent pandemic spike. I don't know, free money printing, the market going up kind of irrationally. Everyone thought they were a great investor, and now they lost 10, 15, 20, sometimes a much higher percentage, and they weren't prepared for it. They thought they were doing the right things, but they weren't around for the volatility. But a valuable lesson if they're a new investor, the thing that scares me is it may have scared away a generation of investors who lost everything in the market because they thought, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And they weren't investing, they were gambling or they were day trading. These are just very different practices. But volatility is the price of returns, right? But if you, this good line, if you view volatility as a fee, things look different. It's not punishment, it's just the price you pay for long-term returns. The market is a discounting mechanism. It's taking all future cash flows, discounted cash flows, and putting them into a price today. As information changes, those prices change, right? Kind of a weird, wonky concept. The market's just a bunch of free cash flows put into a price today. And as new information comes about the economy, it gets priced in. That's volatility. It's news and information all getting baked in on a daily basis into the price of the market. But over time, over history, any 20-year period, you've never underperformed by having money in the market, right? So I think you need to reframe your mindset that nothing's free. You don't get returns in the market just for putting money in and having no stress and no headaches, whatever. I actually do feel this is where place like people like myself, a wealth manager, financial advisor type person, is kind of having these coaching sessions with people like, hey, I just got invested in the market and I lost 10%. I know these things actually happen. That's why I would recommend dollar cost averaging if you have a lump sum, even though mathematically putting in a lump sum all at once probably makes more sense because your money is being put to work right away. And as long as it's for 10 years plus or 15 years plus, you're getting that dividend yield and you're reinvesting that dividend yield, you're going to do better. But psychologically, can you weather the drawdowns? Can you weather the storm of a market correction, of a bear market, right? These are tough things. So nothing's free. Learn to weather volatility. Moving on. You and me. The big idea. Avoid taking financial cues from people playing at a different game than you are. I like this very much. Few things matter more with money than understanding your own time horizon and not being persuaded by the actions and behaviors of people playing different games than you are. Go out of your way to identify what game you're playing and ignore the rest. This is my favorite. This speaks right on to the pandemic. Like, to me, all this said another way, don't have FOMO. You don't know what game other people are playing. I saw something on social media recently. It said, you know, some young socialite type people in New York are going to brunches and they work at an ad agency and they're jetting away to the Hamptons on the weekend. And then they like flash. It's like, what you don't understand is they grew up in this kitchen and they showed a kitchen that was like 3 football fields long. It's like, yeah, they're not paying for their apartment. Their job is almost like their fun money. They're spending money that their brunch. That's the only their expense, and their weekend trips is the only expense because the rest of their life is paid for. Well, sometimes we don't know that. We're like, wait, we have the same job. How are they doing that? How are they driving that fancy car and taking these great trips? You don't know what they're dealing with. Like, they may have a different background if you're making less, right? More importantly, on this FOMO topic, people only talk about their wins at cocktail parties. So you go up like, oh man, I got in on Tesla, made this great trade. I got in on Facebook 3 months ago, doubled my money. Well, what they're not telling you is they also originally bought Facebook at the top because they weren't invested. It was the first time they lost 70%. Then they sold and they panicked. So then they bought it back and now they've doubled their money. They still didn't make their money back. That's not how it works, right? If you lose 50%, you have to make 100% back to get back to even. So you can do that mental math at home. But just know, people are playing different games. So what is your time horizon? What are your goals? If your goal is to, you know, have the nicest car, that's a different game than not caring about what you drive and trying to fund your child's college or your retirement. You might be thinking about retiring at 55 on the beach, and all of a sudden your peers at 55 when you retire, who are living larger than life for 20 years, you go, oh, I'm retired. And they go, what? What do you mean? You're only 55. You got another 10 years to work. And you go, no. I've been saving all of my money. I could have retired at 50. So just know, just play a different game. Don't experience FOMO. Just make sure you know what game you're playing, why you're playing that game, and why it's important for you. Okay? All right. Next one. We got a couple more points here, and then we will be done with this four-part series. This is good. Seduction of pessimism. The big idea. Optimism sounds like a sales pitch. Pessimism sounds like someone trying to help you. This could not be truer. I'm sure he's going to go and he says this a little bit, but like, you see this every day. Pessimists in every situation, in every room, they get to be the smart ones. Oh, look how smart they are. They have so much data and telling you why you should do it. Well, pessimists get to be smart. Optimists get to be rich because they're taking chances. They're believing in the future. They're believing things can improve. Pessimists will tell you, oh, we shouldn't try and sell into that market because it's already saturated. The optimists will say, there's a part of the market that I think we can go after, that we can sell into, that we have a product market fit, that we can expand the pie, we can grow this market. That optimist, that salesperson who's not listening to the old head pessimist, is going to go get rich if they're working on commission and, you know, getting commensurate benefit for opportunity that they're creating for the firm, right? So don't listen to the pessimist. Look, you need to be realistic. You can't just be Pollyanna, everything's pie in the sky, but be an optimist. Here, let's read further. In finance, I like this. Pessimism is paid more attention than optimism. This is like Dr. Doom, Nouriel Roubini, Michael Burry, the Big Short. Michael Burry says sell, deletes his Twitter every 3 months. He's been calling a top since the top of the great financial crisis. He nailed that one. That was awesome. Probably one of the trades of the century. Amazing. He's been wrong ever since. You know who else? Rich Dad, Poor Dad, the Robert Kiyosaki. He's been calling a top and a crash in a market and trying to sell you gold and silver and Bitcoin gold and silver for a decade. And the market has gone straight up. So people are wrong, 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 wrong. And they just get to keep saying it with no consequence. you invest in your future. You have to be a little bit optimistic. If you don't think the market's ever going to go up again, you shouldn't invest, right? All right, let me read this, sorry. In finance, pessimism is paid more attention than optimism and is therefore more persuasive. It's easier to create a narrative around pessimism because the story pieces tend to be fresher and more recent, writes Housel. Optimistic narratives require looking at a long stretch of history and developments, which people tend to forget and take more effort to piece together. True financial optimism, Housel posits, is to expect things to be bad and be surprised when they're not. Yeah, all right. So say it how you want. You want to be a pessimistic optimist, an optimistic pessimist, bunch of wordplay. Point being, save a large percentage of your money for the future. You have to be an optimist. Things will improve. I know there's starving people around the world. There are sick people around the world. There are wars actively being fought right now. But the world has never been safer. The world has never had this much food abundance, this much wealth. Like, things are actually pretty good if you turn off the news and kind of look at world history demographic trends. We're not dying of dysentery, for those Oregon Trail players showing my age. Okay, chapter 18. When you believe anything, stories trump statistics. All right, let's dig in here. Oh. The more you want something to be true, the more likely you're going to believe a story that overestimates the odds of it being true. After World War I ended, for instance, few thought there would be another world war. Housel writes, there are many things in life that we think are true because we desperately want them to be true. He calls these appealing fictions, and they have a big impact on how we think about money, particularly investments and the economy. Yes, we all have an incomplete worldview. We are forming our own narratives to fill in the gaps of what the worldview is. Like, our perception of money is this narrow, this slice, when this much is happening in the world. Like, we just don't have, and rightfully so, like, we just don't have enough bandwidth to understand everything that's happening. So an appealing fiction to color your worldview is actually just, I think, a heuristic shortcut to understand what's going on in the world, right? I don't think there's anything bad that's happening. I like this sentence. It says, we don't wander around blind and confused. We have to think the world we operate in makes sense based on what we happen to know. It'd be too hard to get out of bed in the morning if you felt otherwise, right? Like, I think we are currently seeing this with policymakers and thinking about recession. Morgan kind of hits this like head on here. Says it's hard for a policymaker to predict an outright recession because a recession will make their careers complicated. So even worst case projections rarely expect anything worse than just a slowish growth. It's an appealing fiction and it's easy to believe because expecting anything worse is too painful to consider. Right? So he goes furthermore. Policymakers are easy targets for criticism, but all of us do this to some extent. We do it in both directions. If you think a recession is coming and you cash out your stocks in anticipation, your view of the economy is suddenly going to be warped by what you want to happen. Every blip, every anecdote will look like a sign that doom has arrived. Maybe not because it has, but because you want it to. We see this over and over and over where, you know, the narrative of the doomsdayers, it just doesn't play out. So you need to be optimistic. You need to think long term. Just because the stories make sense and we can fill the gap, that's just not necessarily the way the world works, right? So you have to, back to the previous point, like, stay optimistic, be a realist, but stay invested for the future. Don't bury gold in your backyard. Don't just sit on cash, although now cash you can get 3-4%, so that's probably not too bad. Anyway, I think that's good. So please let me know if you have any questions. If you want me to do any further deep dives on this book, I will leave it there because that was four parts of me talking too much. Check out the book, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for watching.